Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces for you in the latest issue. This week, we're going to be joined by the China expert Ian Williams, who's written about the influence of Chinese technology on the UK, who reflects on the nature of grief, and finally, a review by Deborah Ross of the Oscar-nominated film Promising Young Woman. First, it's Ian Williams.
The government's decision to water down new foreign investment rules designed to protect national security casts serious doubt about its resolve to keep China out of the most sensitive parts of the British economy. Raising the threshold above which an overseas stake must be examined from 15% to 25% will sharply reduce the number of deals facing scrutiny. The amendment to the National Security and Investment Bill, now wending its way through Parliament, was presented by Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng as necessary to show Britain is still open for business. It follows intense lobbying by the Confederation of British Industry, which fears the new rules will deprive industry of investment, just as it is emerging battered and bruised from the COVID pandemic. Look no further than the 2008 financial crash to see where this can lead. In the wake of that meltdown, desperate and wobbly Western companies turned to China for salvation. Beijing obliged with cynical precision. Opaque, state-backed entities snapped up tech and infrastructure firms across Europe, driven by the Chinese Communist Party's strategic objectives as much as by commercial sense. For the grateful recipients, due diligence frequently consisted of little more than counting the number of zeros on the check. The government says it wants the new rules to be proportionate and insists it maintains a great deal of discretion in the way the powers are exercised, though that can cut both ways in times of economic stress. It also points to its resolve in excluding Huawei from Britain's next-generation 5G networks. That is true as far as it goes. The Chinese telecoms giant remains deeply embedded in existing setups and has rapidly expanded research collaboration in the UK, working with 35 institutes and universities, including funding advanced facilities at Cambridge, Edinburgh, Surrey and Imperial College London. It was allowed to buy a stake in Oxford Sciences Innovation, a company that commercialises research from Oxford University. The stake is less than 1%, a toehold, but is that the sort of toe Britain wants in the world's largest fund dedicated to academic spin-offs? Britain has been a popular and welcoming destination for Chinese investment, estimated to be worth more than £50 billion between 2010 and last year. Until now, there's been very little in the way of regulation or scrutiny. Chinese companies have invested heavily in property, including the Leadenhall building in the city, otherwise known as the Cheese Grater. Chinese investors own Pizza Express, Thomas Cook, Wolves and Southampton football clubs, and a company that builds black cabs. A Chinese sovereign wealth fund holds minority stakes in Thames Water and Heathrow Airport, while China's National Offshore Oil Corporation is responsible for around a quarter of UK North Sea oil production. Chinese entities have also bought stakes in the National Grid's gas distribution arm and Global Switch, one of the world's largest cloud data providers. But it's Chinese tech companies that present the most worrying challenge. Despite Huawei being excluded from 5G, other businesses are being welcomed into sensitive corners of the British economy with little scrutiny, in spite of growing concerns in intelligence agencies that they could be used by Beijing for espionage, surveillance, or the collection of sensitive data. Take Hikvision, the world's biggest seller of surveillance cameras, and a leader in the marriage of those cameras with artificial intelligence. This includes facial recognition, freshly calibrated to cope with COVID-19 masks, and gait recognition, identifying the unique way an individual walks. There are even cameras able to read emotions. Think Tom Cruise and Minority Report, identifying crimes before they take place. Hikvision has close links to the CCP. It's an enabler of Xi Jinping's dystopian surveillance state and has been blacklisted by the US government for facilitating repression in Xinjiang. Yet an estimated 1.3 million Hikvision cameras are being used in the UK by airports, councils and NHS trusts. More than half of London councils own Chinese surveillance cameras. UK intelligence agencies are reportedly pushing for curbs on smart cities technology supplied by China. This is the umbrella term for surveillance cameras, sensors and other intelligent systems that will supposedly keep our future cities ticking over, but collect a chilling amount of data in the process. Hikvision, Alibaba and Huawei are all key suppliers. NukeTech, which has been called the Huawei of airport security, supplies scanners to British airports and seaports. It is part owned by the China National Nuclear Corporation, a leading defence conglomerate with deep roots in the country's military as well as civil nuclear programmes. The British government has held discussions with ByteDance, the Chinese owner of video sharing platform TikTok, about setting up an international headquarters in London, in spite of concerns over its close links with the CCP and the security of data for which it has a voracious appetite. In America, TikTok agreed to pay $92 million to settle a class action lawsuit alleging its app illegally tracked users and shared biometric data from photos and videos without their consent. The company denies any wrongdoing. The BBC has signed co-production deals with Tencent, a Chinese tech giant that owns WeChat, the app for everything, and a key component of disinformation and social control in China, and increasingly beyond. TikTok and WeChat are vast data-gathering machines, and data has been described as the new oil of the world economy, central to the global AI race now gathering pace. It's the raw material to train the hungry algorithms of AI. China has no restraint on its collection at home and is increasingly looking abroad to harvest more. Beijing talks a lot about building the world's digital infrastructure and smart cities, both part of the package on offer under its Belt and Road Initiative. In the Chinese context, these are inextricably linked with surveillance, control, and hoovering data. Many Chinese tech companies protest that they're private and commercial, but private companies don't exist in any meaningful sense in Xi's China. The CCP has extended and enhanced its power within every company, overseeing key decisions. National security, intelligence, and cyber laws all require companies to cooperate on demand. Civil-military partnership, the transfer of know-how to the military, is enshrined in China's constitution. China's tech companies are partners in the surveillance state and are its international standard bearers. Many are heavily subsidized and protected and often strategically deployed. China General Nuclear Power Group, blacklisted in America and accused of stealing technology for military use, is an investor in the UK's troubled Hinkley Point nuclear plant. It also has an option on a stake in a French-designed plant at Sizewell C, but its real target is Bradwell in Essex, where it wants to build an entire reactor of its own, the first Chinese-owned plant in the West. Much as it did with Huawei's telecoms technology, China sees the UK as a springboard for international sales. Chinese tech companies have benefited from their government's cyber espionage, forced technology transfer and IP theft. But Western tech companies continue to be willing enablers of the surveillance state. Last year, Zoom, the video conferencing app that came of age during the COVID-19 pandemic, shut down online meetings commemorating the June the 4th Tiananmen Square massacre and suspended accounts of participants at the request of China. As a result, UK federal prosecutors have served a criminal complaint against one of the company's China-based employees. It makes for fascinating reading. Zoom at one point allegedly created accounts for Chinese intelligence agents who were given access to Zoom's internal messaging system. The company agreed to proactively report and give them early warning on a regular basis of illegal meetings and to monitor content for unacceptable political views. In response to the complaint, Zoom has depicted itself as a young company navigating unfamiliar terrain. It has blamed lax internal controls and a rogue employee who has been sacked. Another battle the West is losing is over international technical standards, which define how tech works and its interoperability. The West has allowed China almost free rein in the 200-odd global organisations and bodies which set these standards, particularly in the emerging fields of AI, 5G and the Internet of Things. Beijing even has an initiative, China Standards 2035, aimed to impose its own rules on the global system by that date. Technology is never neutral. The same tech can be purposed and repurposed in different ways and in different contexts. It can embody political, economic, and wider moral and ethical values. The US Congress has been considering an Algorithm Accountability Act, which would force companies to assess the impact of AI systems. The narrow debate over investment rules frequently ignores these wider issues and challenges. It should be remembered that President Xi has not hesitated in weaponizing trade and investment, using them as instruments of coercion. This is one reason why a concentration on percentage stakes in the new bill is blinkered. Australia is facing damaging economic sanctions from China after it had the audacity to call for an independent inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. It provides a chilling example of where overdependence on China can lead.
That was Ian Williams. And now Fiona Mountford.
No one can say that. Over the course of the past year, we have not had the opportunity as a country to practice the grim arts of grief and mourning. We all know the figures, 127,000 COVID deaths and counting. But I wonder if, in the face of this onslaught, we have lost sight of the vital fact that behind each loss, there will be a group of family members and close friends of the deceased setting out on the long, slow trudge down the boggy path of grief. How are we dealing with this suffering? When my father died extremely suddenly 6 years ago, there was one thing for which I was even more unprepared than the abrupt absence of the most cheerful person I had ever had the pleasure to know. It was the fact that far too many people found it hard to look me in the eye and say how sorry they were for my loss. That is all it would have taken, a simple and clear acknowledgement of a terrible event, but it happened with dispiriting infrequency. Instead, my mother and I were subjected to excruciating hours of small talk while the grief-shaped elephant in the room trumpeted and trampled. Mum and I took to calling this the conspiracy of silence. Our sadness made other people feel awkward, and their awkwardness trumped our need to talk and gasp, even cry, in the immediate aftermath. Why British people have such a fear of the tears of others remains a mystery to me. When I am feeling charitable, I tell myself that the human instinct is to want to fix things that are wrong, and death remains the ultimate unfixable event. I regret to say that I do not always feel charitable. This widespread skirting around of our sadness winded me at first and later enraged me. I have discussed it with others who have suffered major loss, and they all report the same. Some people, to use the modish phrase, lean into a friend's suffering, while others do the opposite. What is even more bewildering is that the people in these two camps are often not quite who you might have predicted beforehand. At least I did not have to endure, as one recently bereaved friend did, someone crossing the street to avoid having to talk to her. Have we really got so little emotional capacity as that? Have we not learnt that saying, "I am so sorry for you, I don't know what else to say," is infinitely better than saying nothing at all? I can't help but wonder whether the situation has shifted in a year that has seen death on such a scale. The optimist in me would like to think it has. The pragmatist suspects it has not. The effect of lockdown on national mental health has opened up all sorts of avenues of public discussion, a heartening example of something good coming from something so dreadful. But have we as individuals, as communities, developed more sophisticated mechanisms for dealing with others' grief? Are we talking openly and sincerely to those we know who have embarked on this weary and frustratingly non-linear road? Or are we still under the malevolent spell of the conspiracy of silence? It is useful to consider how other countries managed this hardest of emotional negotiations. Much as we like to mock the heart-on-sleeviness of Americans, there is much to be said for their tendency to an open expression of sentiment at the times when it really matters. In some Eastern societies, there continues the tradition of professional mourners at funerals. Although this practice looks insincere to Western eyes, it at least acknowledges the central role that audible and visible grief should be afforded. There is no stiff upper lip nonsense there. It speaks volumes that modern Brits can manage easy, often mawkish outpourings of grief for public figures, Princess Di, Captain Sir Tom, Prince Philip. But when it matters most in our private lives, continue to be so inept about it. Social media only serves to highlight the disconcerting disconnect between these two spheres. Online grief comes accompanied by huge expressions of sympathy and tweets stuffed full of crying-faced emojis, whereas offline is a different story. How can it not wound the bereaved, this disjunction between public warmth and private coldness, between show and tell? I recently wrote a piece for this magazine about funerals, referencing my father's. I emailed the web link to a dozen or so friends who had attended the sad event. The response was fascinating, but also predictable. Those who had lent into our grief at the time responded promptly with thoughtful words. Those who had found it too awkward back then ignored my email. The conspiracy of silence, it seems, is not going to give up without a fight.
That was Fiona Mountford. And finally, Deborah Ross.
Promising Young Woman is a rape revenge thriller that has already proved divisive, but is a wonderfully clever, darkly funny, stomach-knotting, my stomach may never unknot, exploration of what, hashtag not all men, seem to get. It isn't okay to have sex with a woman who's had a few too many and isn't in a position to give consent. Unless, of course, she is also out late at night and wearing a short skirt, in which case, asking for it. We all know that. This is written and directed by the extraordinary polymath that is Emerald Fennell, who was head writer for the second series of Killing Eve, has collaborated with Andrew Lloyd Webber on his forthcoming Cinderella, and is a novelist and actress. She played Camilla Parker Bowles in The Crown. I don't know if she's also a black belt at judo, but there has to be a chance. It stars Carey Mulligan as Cassie, a medical school dropout whose best friend Nina committed suicide after she was raped at a college party while other boys looked on, laughing. Cassie now lives with her despairing parents, works in a coffee shop, and has an unusual hobby, revenge, served cold, and also often. Every week she goes to a club where she appears to be head-lollingly, flat-out, falling down drunk. one man might nudge another. Look at that. God Almighty, get some dignity, sweetheart, he might say, while also sensing an opportunity. The man will take her back to his place, and just as he's getting her knickers off, she will sit bolt upright, stone cold sober, and say, what are you doing? It's a shock. It's stressful. It's stomach knotting. If he knows he can't have sex with her now she's sober, why did he think he could when she was drunk? But he's not a rapist. I'm a nice guy, he will remonstrate. Are you? She will counter. No one was ever made accountable for Nina, and a decade on, Cassie's pain and anger and trauma are embedded. She seeks revenge not just on random, shitty guys, but also on the lawyer who defends accused college boys, and the girlfriend who did not stand by Nina, and the dean of the college who took no action. Ruin a young man's life every time an accusation is made. Have him expelled. But then Cassie meets Ryan, played by Bo Burnham, a paediatric surgeon who has been a very, very nice fella. They fall in love, indie rom-com style, with montages and a dance routine down the pharmacy, and they're funny together and sweet, and now you are angry. Really? A man comes along to make it all right. This is her salvation. That's the twist. Actually, no, it isn't. Or, to put it another way, the twist has a twist. This is an extremely twisty film, and you won't be able to predict any of it. This wrong-foots us in all sorts of ways, and is discomforting in all sorts of ways. It is bloodthirsty and furious, but its visuals are all stylized high femme, candy colours, cute nail polish, ditzy floral dresses. The soundtrack is sometimes pop, and sometimes ominous horror movie strings, and sometimes what sounds like both, as when Britney Spears' Toxic is slowed right down. Mulligan's performance, meanwhile, is intense and fiery and electrifying, even if she's nowhere near good-looking enough. Joke, but you'll have to look it up to understand the history. The ending has proved especially divisive, particularly due to one near unbearable scene. But a film may raise the subject of gendered violence and sexual assault without necessarily offering a solution. The patriarchy has been around for 10,000 years and you can't expect Emerald Fennell to single-handedly see it off, unless she can. Perhaps she'll get round to that next year.
That was Deborah Ross. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. Remember, if you like the magazine, you can take out a subscription for it if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher, where you also get a free £20 Amazon voucher. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.